My guest today, Stephen Shehi, is an internationally known author, scholar, and activist. Currently, he's associate professor of Arabic and Arab culture at the University of South Carolina, having received his PhD in Near Eastern Studies from the University of Michigan. His articles have appeared in the International Journal of Middle Eastern Studies, the British Journal of Middle East Studies, Journal of Arabic Literature, and the Journal of Comparative South Asian, African, and Middle Eastern Studies, plus opinion pieces on contemporary issues of the Middle East in an array of newspapers and journals nationally and internationally. Stephen Shehi is the author of Foundations of Modern Arab Identity, published in 2004, and Islamophobia, the Ideological Campaigning as Muslims, published last year, which we'll be talking about today. It has a preface by Mumia Abu-Jamal and a foreword by Ward Churchill. He is currently completing his forthcoming book on the history of photography in the Middle East, entitled Arab Imago, A Social History of Indigenous Photography, which will be published by Princeton University. Welcome, Professor Shehi, to Takes on the World.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really glad to have you. A few weeks before the appearance on YouTube of the trailer for The Innocence of Muslims, and the almost simultaneous appearance of ads on the side of New York City buses implying that Muslims are savages, a friend sent me a copy of your book, Islamophobia, The Ideological Campaign Against Muslims. And after reviewing the book, I expect that neither the placing of the film on YouTube nor the bus ads came as a surprise to you.
No, I was talking on another show a couple of days ago, and I think I shocked everyone. I said, at some level, it's kind of boring, right? You know, it's just a repeat of stuff that we see ever so often, and these sort of episodic sort of fits of this blatant hate that elicits certain reactions elsewhere and allows certain voices to come in and mediate that on the home front. And allows Obama to come out and tell how the United States are benevolent empires or empire, and the next day we have an election or something.
It's interesting. Even in Bill Keller, the New York Times on Monday, acknowledged that Islamophobia is an accepted form of bigotry in the United States. And again, then he pointed out that it wasn't a problem so much for Muslims here or in the Middle East, North Africa, Southwest, Southeast Asia, but that it encourages anti-American rants. So even in this particular instance, we are the non-Muslims are the victims.
Right. I mean, exactly. Talking about Islamophobia now has taken on so many facets. I think when I was writing the book, definitely it was less talked about. And I think my book came out right at the cusp of sort of an explosion of publications and discussions about the matter. But yeah, I mean, it's got a lot of facets. But as you said, I mean, it's funny about now, and I had just read actually Pam Geller's American Freedom Defense Initiative, like blog or whatever. I mean, this self-important person can't even get a goddamn website. She always has to use some sort of blog, free blog for her propaganda. But either way,
three blogs. Pam Geller says three blogs.
Exactly. You know, and so she was basically saying how Islamophobic all of her detractors are because they make her. They grasped onto her their hate of Muslims and their sort of homogenizing all Muslims, where she really doesn't mean that. She only means the, you know, so many high percentage of Muslims who are actually jihadis. It's funny. The conversation about Islamophobia is now coming back, right? Coming back to somehow defend white privilege and American empire. And
she has been actually... For somebody who is so openly racist and without been so unapologetic, she started the fight to prevent the Park 51 mosque from being built. Everyone came to believe it was like right on the site of the World Trade Center. It was four blocks away, but she has been accorded so much airtime and space on the mainstream U.S. media. And even on October 2011, the U.S. Marine Corps presented her with a flag flown on September 11th over Camp Leatherneck. Quote, he says, amid the battlefields of Afghanistan during decisive operations against enemy forces in Helmand Province, they awarded her that flag. The American military, we have seen, of course, pictures of Abu Ghraib and Marines urinating on corpses of dead Afghan soldiers. But all this is what we see on the videos and YouTube. It's like the Rodney King case. Most times we don't see what. There is no, are no pictures of these incidents. How do you connect this, the Islamophobia prevalent in the United States with the behavior of our troops in the Middle East?
Right. I think I'm going to slightly hijack the question. And on one hand, I think, just to answer initially the question is that, you know, in the end, the American military is an extension of American culture. I mean, we don't have a culture in the United States as they do elsewhere, where you have a sort of a military culture unto itself, right, that rules a civil society, you know, say, you know, in Syria or Pinochet's,
Chile, yeah.
Chile or something like that. You know? What the army and military actually brag about is that it's the real integrator, it's the real sort of face of America, and I think to some degree it is. So really, American troops carry with them the cultural baggage that they grow up with. And that cultural baggage is American distrust and dislike and disdain for brown people and people of the South, and so they sort of carry that with them. And on the other hand, though, and this is where I want to sort of again hijack the question. The question is that these sort of American extremists like Geller, they are given a forum that they should not be given in the mainstream, because in the end they're packs, right? It looks like my 12-year-old put together this website, so they are real hacks, and they're given far more attention than they should, and they really do reflect, I think, a smaller percentage in some respect than they would like to admit, even though their sort of racism is prevalent, if that can make sense. So they say racist stuff that most mainstream Americans really are smart enough not to say, even though they might or might not think it. But what I think their actions actually allow, and if you look at, for example, the urinating on the incident, it allows the mainstream to intervene and reassure themselves that they are not Islamophobes or racist, right? So, for example, now the army court-martialed two guys for urinating on corpses. Okay, a few other guys got a slap on the wrist, but in the end, people kind of in the army are kind of pissed off about that because it makes them look bad and it's a breach of protocol and stuff, right? So we can say that these guys are an aberration and that in the end, the army is this great leveler and, colorblind, et cetera. So when you have these fringe elements or these fringe acts, it allows the mainstream to come in and reassert how they really are, quote unquote, tolerant, fair, not racist. So you have the MTA in New York, for example, that refused to put up the billboards, or you have the ADL, coming out strongly against this. And again, ADL does some good stuff. In the end, they're no friend of the Palestinians by all means, but it allows groups like ADL or municipal groups, the state, the MTA, to come in and say, "Oh, we don't accept this sort of hate speech." So it's kind of ironic, right, that these acts of the mainstream allows these extremists to come in and spew their garbage, so that gives them an opportunity to come in and say, well, you know, that's free speech, and we're going to let you talk like that. But in the end, it's really not acceptable.
And they give this organization like the Anti-Defamation League, which in its way is as responsible for Islamophobia as any other organization, to look good as if it's defending Muslims against racist propaganda.
Right, exactly. What I said perhaps unelegantly is that these extremist acts allow, quote-unquote, the racist, you know, sort of the racist mainstream to come in and give themselves credibility again, because they sort of they're allowed to distance themselves from what is the Islamophobia that is culturally inherent to American culture.
One of the things I was just occurred to me quite recently in reading about and learning more from your book about their surveillance of the Muslim American mm-hmm. communities by various law enforcement agencies. This seems to be, in a way, a substitute for the incarceration of the Japanese in 1945, if they had the ability to survey and keep track on Japanese Americans in 1945, there would have been, 1941, there would have been no reason to put them in concentration camps. This way, we read repeatedly of arrests being made, and all of them are based on stings. In which the most notorious was this fellow Craig Steele, who is an American pretending to convert to Islam, and which actually This American Life did an excellent program on that, which was heard on the station. But there doesn't seem any outrage in the non-Muslim communities about what's going on.
Right. Well. I definitely love to talk about the FBI and Craig Monte, whatever his name is. Just to sort of pick up on the first part of that I think it's a great and very interesting observation that you made about Japanese, you know, Korematsu or whatever, the internment program and the surveillance. What the effect of the surveillance of Muslim Americans does is effectively puts them in a virtual prison. They are, you know, where they have to be hyper vigilant, and in fact, they are hyper vulnerable to any expression of dissent against the United States government. These surveillance programs are parallel to what happened to the Japanese, even though I think we need to say that the Japanese suffered far more than the Arab American and Muslim American community, which is generally a pretty privileged community. And so we want to make sure then to not undercut the value and the pain and the historical insult of the Japanese Americans, who have always actually been very supportive of Arab American and Muslim American civil liberties, and that has to be noted. So you look at these the programs of surveillance, and the programs of surveillance, which is quite sinister about them, is that they operate on a lot of different levels. Right, on one hand, they're municipal city programs that are like in New York City, where, in fact, they take sort of extraterritorial privileges in going and spying on places that's not even their jurisdiction, right? And when I saw that happen, when I saw that the NYPD got outed, I completely knew that this was happening and that we would find out about other programs like this in the country, which we ended up doing in Chicago and in L.A., for example. And secondly is, of course, their collusion also with branches of government that the municipality should not be messing with, like the CIA. So how the CIA, in fact, actually helped to run this program indirectly. Then we have, and again, we can sort of push it off or explain it away, saying, "Oh, this is not in the United States. This is the state, you know, of New York or the city of New York or whatever, right? But then we also learn that, in fact, these programs actually exist on the federal level, on the national level, through the FBI, who spy regularly on Muslim American communities. At the same time, they're trying to enlist Muslim American communities to help them discern credible threats. So what's really important is that this cooperation that the American Muslim community has been engaged in for several years, actually since 9/11, continually reassures us that the Muslim Americans are doing what they should be doing, and the FBI are continually trying to provoke them. So, for example, yes, there's that famous Orange County example, which I usually talk about, but more recently there was, I don't know if you've heard about, in Chicago. There's an 18-year-old, 19-year-old kid who allegedly tried to blow up a bar in Chicago. And so, you know, as always, the Attorney General's office or whatever, there's a big thing. We got this guy, and they set him up, and it's, you know, got him dead to rights, and they sat in the car with his finger on the detonator, pushed the fake detonator. The FBI comes and, arrests the guy. And we, of course, we learn that there's an agent provocateur, an informant who cultivated this kid. And he is a kid. He's 19 years old. And they've been cultivating him for like a year or two, right? Since he was probably like eight, just turned legal. So everyone hears about this, ooh, bad, you know, Muslim terror, homegrown stuff, you know, Peter King stuff happening in the United States. We got to be scared. As we learn the facts, we also find out, and no one listens to this part because it's not in the soundbite, later on, when documents are released, FBI transcripts are released, we find out that there is a second alleged assailant who pulls out before this attack was going to happen. And he was the guy, I think, who actually gave the idea, was giving ideas, let's go bomb a concert or something. So he was kind of into it. But effectively what happened is that the imam of the mosque, or the sheikh of the mosque in Chicago, heard them talking about this and chewed their asses out and really yelled at them and said, what are you guys doing? And effectively, the leadership of the mosque intervened and tried to turn these guys, even though at the same time, the FBI agents provocateurs are trying to, you know, push them and provide all the resources, of course, the sort of investigation is going on. So we don't hear the quote-unquote success of the American Muslim community, how they in fact regulate themselves, watch themselves, and take care of themselves. We actually hear to the contrary, that there are these homegrown American threats.
Well, even the case in Craig Monte, he was reported on by members of the mosque that they thought that he was a terrorist. But the FBI wasn't interested because he was their man, and the person who reported him was in turn arrested and accused of terrorism.
Well, actually, and Niazi, the Afghani guy, actually, who did that, which is interesting, is that, if you look at how that broke down, I think it was in Tuscan, the mosque, they did exactly what they should do, right? The sheikh of the mosque went to the Orange County Care Office. The Orange County Care Office, Council of American Islamic Relations office. They went to the larger office in L.A., who coordinated with the FBI. Then the L.A. office contacted the FBI, and then they said, oh, really? Oh, my God, okay. knowing it's their man. As you said, not only did they get this guy and put him in jail, actually, and deport him, they did that because he refused to become an informant. They were trying to turn him because he's here on a visa or something like this, and they said, you know, guess what? We're going to have you imprisoned or deported because you have ties to the Taliban. Ends up his like brother-in-law is somebody, or you know, might have known a Taliban one time. But you know, in the Middle East, you know, basically the countries are small enough where like you know, degrees of separation from things and people aren't too distant. So everybody knows as somebody in Lebanon, you know, who's Hezbollah, you know, let alone married to one, you know, or Hamas or Taliban or whatever, you know. just like, you know, in Italy in the 1970s, everyone knew somebody who was close or knew somebody who was associated maybe with, you know, the Red Brigade or a radical communist, you know. So it's not that hard just by degrees of separation. And so they tried to turn this guy. He said no, and they were going to throw him in jail and convict him for being a, being a terror suspect.
And this is a pattern that's repeated. Well, it's been used in other situations and other struggles, but it's a typical police pattern of trying to intimidate someone into becoming an informer. And it has a long and sordid history. The situation is we hear these stories. The case of the Iranian American auto dealer who was supposed to have tried to hire the Zeta cartel to kill the Saudi ambassador in Washington, but not just kill him in a hotel, in a restaurant, and kill hundreds of people. There's been no trial, yet this has been accepted as a proven fact by the pundits who write in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and so on, who are part of the Israeli media collective, I call them, you know, the stable of the lobby has that informs the American public who are the good guys and who are the bad guys in the Middle East.
Right. Well, it's funny, that instance actually is connected to what I think is an emerging discourse that we'll see more of, which is the Bolivarian-Iranian Hezbollah access. Where there are several instances, and I can't pull them, I'm blanking right now, but there are several instances where we see attempts made by certain people and within the government. I mean, this is not some sort of, you know, Zionist conspiracy or whatever. I mean, people who are neocons and whomever in the government who try to establish a relationship between Hezbollah, basically Lebanese Shia, and Bolivarians of South America, and how they're going to sort of like killer bees come up through Central America and infiltrate the United States. And they're going to do that by making connections with drug cartels. And they do that because, of course, they can do that, of course, because that connection exists because of the historic merchant communities in West Africa. So what happens is that you go from Hezbollah in Lebanon to all their associates, the Lebanese expats who are dealing allegedly in, you know, illegal diamonds and drugs in West Africa, and their connections to Venezuela, and then of course, you know, this is how they make their solidarity ties with those anti-imperialists in Venezuela against good American virtues. And, so yeah, I would say we want to keep an eye on that sort of that discourse, which you might see sooner than later.
My guess is to Professor Stephen Shehi, and we're talking about his book Islamophobia and its presence in the United States. The situation with Hezbollah is really interesting. Hezbollah has been blamed, is the first organization to be blamed for just about any quote-unquote terrorist act takes place anywhere in the world. They don't need any evidence. Richard Armitage called it once the A-team of terrorism. Of course, they've always failed to mention, when they say it developed in the 80s, they usually fail to mention it developed as a resistance to Israeli occupation, to the Israeli invasion and occupation. And one thing I noticed you mentioned in your book, Islamophobia crosses the gamut from left to right. And during Hezbollah's resistance of 18 years resistance to the Israeli occupation, the only armed resistance to Israel at the time, there was almost no support that I could see from any so-called left organization that had supported liberation struggles around the world. And I would attribute this, as you may as well, to an Islamophobia that is not as obvious but exists within the left as well as the right.
Right. Well, two things. I mean, I completely agree with you that the left and definitely, you know, liberal America harbors a lot of Islamophobia. But John, I'm just going to make it a small sidebar into one slight correction of your historical narrative, is that, yes, Hezbollah arose as a resistance movement. It sees itself as a resistance movement. It finds its credibility largely as a resistance movement. It also finds credibility in, as a civil rights movement, defending the rights of the Shia in the Shiites in Lebanon, which are in fact were an oppressed minority for many, many years. In fact, they probably had the most, they do have the most amount of people in terms of its largest population, but had at least privilege, and you know, they were the poorest communities, et cetera, and had less access to power in the government. In the 1980s, though, they did not start the resistance. The resistance, in fact, was a leftist-led resistance. It was led by the National Movement, which was a consortium of many left-wing militias and parties. And, in fact, it was led by sort of they all elected the one sort of intellectual leader or the political leader was, in fact, a Lebanese communist. Well, he wasn't a Lebanese communist. He was a sort of a Trotskyite, yeah. Part of a break-off, very small guy named Mohsen Ibrahim. So in the 1980s, there was a resistance against Israeli occupation, and that resistance was in fact led by leftists and in concert with the Palestinians until the Palestinians were expelled in 1982. And after that, even then, the communists, the Syrian Socialist Party, which were actually fascists, were also involved. But basically, it was Lebanese communists and leftists. When Hezbollah came along, actually what they did is they annihilated the leadership of the Lebanese Communist Party and a lot of the militants and took over. So they really became de facto. It was a civil war, and it was a terrible and horrible place, and everybody, and you had constant changing loyalties. But we have to remember that the resistance actually is rooted in leftism in Lebanon, and Hezbollah ended up sort of taking it over one way or another. Now, that said and done, they very successfully took it over by the mid-late 80s and led a very, very successful, very disciplined resistance. Again, in concert with other militias who contributed, but they were really in power. But yeah, I mean, and this is where they draw their credibility from, is that Hezbollah, in the end, for what everyone might say about them, is a successful political institution, and it also draws its credibility from being one of the few political and military organizations that have successfully confronted Israel. I think what happens is, and just to tie it back into the question, is that, yeah, leftists don't like that in the United States. Leftists feel that resistance have to have, you know, striped white and blue shirts with little, you know, berets and smoking gitan blonde. And that's not what the resistance doesn't look like that. But, you know, and as we see in this Charlie Hebdo issue, where it has all these caricatures of Muhammad, that this is a leftist publication.
But very anti-Muslim for quite some time. I mean,
exactly.
Yes.
No, and it has a sort of, it's a different context in the United States. You know, it has this sort of hyper sense of secularism, and it's very French, right? The very, very French hyper laïcité sort of sense of secularism is how you have a state, and they sort of take it to the leftists or to the elements of atheism, and you know, anyone who is, you know, believes too much in has a faith belief is kind of silly. They're quite offensive, and they're very racist. They're racist because, in the end, they're French white leftists. And the French white leftists share in their own race privilege and can't sort of really extend themselves to understand how faith-based movements might actually be almost as radical as them. Even though, again, I mean, I'm a secularist and I'm an atheist and all that, but I'm just saying they're just, I think we have to look at their own Islamophobia.
This is what I found there from my experience. What is very interesting is the deliberate refusal by the Western media to acknowledge the support that Hezbollah has among the Maronite Christians in Lebanon, not only General Aoun and his Free progressive movement, but two other smaller Lebanese Christian parties, and that alliance got the majority of votes in the last time they had election in Lebanon. I actually had a chance to interview General Aoun, the former president, when I was in Lebanon about 4 or 5 years ago, and he said quite openly that without Hezbollah, Israel would just do what it would want to Lebanon.
Right.
And in a way, this terrible thing that's going on within Syria, one of the targets is Hezbollah, because Israel has found itself unable to defeat Hezbollah militarily.
Right. It's a really great topic, and it really embodies the complexities of Islamophobia on one level, but also how Islamophobia is linked into American empire, but also how, when we really want to understand these political groups, we have to understand the mechanics of how they are working locally. You know, Americans think that everything revolves around them. They think that if Hezbollah does something, it's just because to piss them, you know, Americans off, or to scare the Israelis. And it's really silly, and it's very narcissistic, right? Just like you said about, you know, in the beginning of our conversation about, Islamophobia somehow, it's hurting us as white Americans, right? They really think that, you know, the sun shines out their bottom. But to really understand Hezbollah is to understand it within its local context, within its national context. And you talk about Hakam Aoun and the Maronites. Those alliances are drawn upon other parties in opposition, right? So, for example, if we're going to bring it, to make it very current and bring it back to Islamophobia, bring it back to, you know, the demonstrations that we're seeing in the Middle East, Hezbollah really didn't do anything. You know, they're the marquee, right, terrorist fanatics, right, for everybody, right? They're the face of that. But in the end, it's obviously silly. They haven't done anything. They didn't have any demonstrations until a couple of days ago, when Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, saw basically all the stuff that's happening in the Middle East. They made a political demonstration, which was far more disciplined and impressive than, you know, 2,000, you know, Pakistanis rioting or something like that. It's very organized. So they did this big demonstration, but they do it for a reason. They did it for a reason because if you think about the local context and regional context, it's who, you know, Hezbollah, some of their biggest adversaries, other than Israel and the United States, are Sunni Salafis, right?
Right.
And so you have the Salafis in the street claiming the mantle of the Prophet. That puts Hezbollah in a difficult position. They had to somehow make a statement, a political statement, for their own political credibility in the region and in Lebanon, right? Because in the meantime, they're the people who hate Hezbollah slightly less than the United States and Israel are the Salafis. Who they're also, so that's why you have this rioting. So you have these Salafis now in Tripoli burning Kentucky Fried Chickens, sort of stealing the sort of anti-imperialist credibility from them. But on the other hand, at the same time, fighting Bashar al-Assad in Syria. So you can see the sort of complexity of Hezbollah's position and understanding who they are. You know,
they were put in a very difficult position by the Syrian uprising, simply because Syria has stood behind, even though the situation in Syria and Lebanon are very different, Syria has stood behind Hezbollah all these years, and obviously Hezbollah saw very quickly that there were these elements, Salafi elements and outside elements, that had nothing to do with Syrian desire for Syrian independence or freedom or democracy, that it penetrated and kind of usurped the Syrian uprising.
Right. Yeah, I mean, again, I think to some, you know, Hezbollah was riding on a real high in the region until 2011. Again, they had the only real credentials for resisting American imperialism and in, you know, basically Israeli policies and Zionism in the Middle East. They pretty much had the only real sort of scorecard, winning scorecard. Problem is then, you know, the quote-unquote Arab Spring sort of mucks things up and makes things very, very sort of confusing. Because it's confusing because the prism by which we look at it is one that is inevitably, you know, structured by American power, right? Where you're either with American power or against American power. So, you know, if you're with American power, then we say, oh, geez, you know, there are these uprisings. What do we do in Egypt? But then if we're, you know, against American power, we say, oh, yeah, we should have to love Hezbollah. But then if we love Hezbollah, then we have to sort of somehow respect Syria. Syria, that's the problem. The Ba'athist regime was a heinous regime, right? It was awful, you know. It's awful and it's brutal and has been for you know, 35 years or 40 years. But they are the ally of Hezbollah. So what Hezbollah didn't really have a choice. Plus the political alliance between Syria and Iran, they really don't have a choice. At the same time, as I said, and we can't undersell this enough, is Shiites are threatened in the Middle East. And this is where, you know, American Islamophobia completely blinds them from the nuances of the Middle East.
Stephen. This is incredibly interesting. I'd love to go on, but we've come to the end of the hour. I really want to thank you. I didn't open the phones. It was so intriguing. My guest was Stephen Shehi, and he's written a book called Islamophobia, the Ideological Campaign Against Muslims, published by Clarity Press. Please go to your local bookstore, and if they don't have it, I don't think they'll probably have it, but they can order it, right?
I certainly can.
From Clarity Press. It's called Islamophobia, the Ideological Campaign Against Muslims by Stephen Shehi, S-H-E-E-H-I. Thank you so much, Stephen, for being our guest today on Takes of the World. I really appreciate speaking with you and getting your information.
Thanks so much for having me.
And hope to do it again, actually.
I hope so.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Great. Cheers.
Bye-bye.